Blog Talk Radio.
From Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training centers in Denver, Colorado, and Anchorage, Alaska, this is Dog Works Radio, committed to families and their dogs to build lifelong and fulfilling relationships. Visit our website at dogworksradio.com. Dog Works Radio is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Now, here are your hosts, Robert and Michelle Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto from Willow, Alaska, and on the line we have calling in an author, writer, and soldier, Kevin Hanoran. Kevin, how's it going? I'm sorry I butchered your name the first time. We'll get it right the second.
No worries, Robert. I'm doing good, thank you.
Good to talk to you as well. I know you and I met over Twitter and love what you're doing on your blog. Great stuff there. If you could, introduce yourself and tell us who you are and what you're all about.
I'm sure. My name is Kevin Hanoran, and I'm an active duty lieutenant colonel in the United States Army. And I'm also an advocate for our military working dogs as well as our service dogs for our veterans suffering from PTSD. And I am also an author with one novel currently being sent to publishers in the next couple weeks or so, and hopefully many more after that. And the subjects of my books are military working dogs and the soldiers in Afghanistan.
So your novel that's going to be released is called Paws on the Ground, right?
That's correct. And Paws on the Ground is actually terminology we used. I ran the dog program for Afghanistan in 2010 to 2011, and that's what, you know, it's a playoff, boots on the ground, and we used to count boots on the ground consistently in Afghanistan in 2010 because we could only have 98,000 soldiers at a time in Afghanistan because that was the cap for soldiers, but there was no cap on paws on the ground, so we were always just sort of funny. We always used to kid around about that.
Very cool. So give us a little bit of a history, if you can. I know you were instrumental in getting those paws on the ground, so to speak, in Afghanistan. If you could, just give us a little history about that.
Sure. When I first got to Afghanistan, it was right after the surge. And it was the surge when we brought around 30,000 soldiers into Afghanistan. And a lot of those were sent down south to where the traditional strongholds of the Taliban were in the Kandahar province. And they brought in a lot of combat forces, but they didn't bring a lot of enablers in. And one of those enablers that they desperately needed were those military working dogs. There was, I first recognized the value of the dogs on the battlefield when I received an urgent message from the brigade operations officer of the 2nd Brigade, 101st Airborne Division. And this was, about a month after I had gotten to Afghanistan. And the brigade had been assigned to the treacherous Agandam Valley in southern Afghanistan. That's the valley where the Soviet Union was defeated back in the 1980s. Now, the region is the gateway to the Taliban spiritual capital of Kandahar. And I'll never forget this. The brigade operations officer told me that they were losing soldiers every single day to improvised explosive devices.
Wow.
And they were only able to deploy about 10% of their combat power in the sector. Because every time they did, their kids were being killed and maimed by these IEDs. You know, and that just changed my life. And he told me the only thing that was working to defeat these IEDs were our four-legged furry pals. And so he begged me to get him more teams. And that's something that we absolutely did. We flooded hundreds and hundreds of teams into Afghanistan by the time I was leaving, about 8 and 9 months later.
Holy cow. Well, you know, congratulations for that miraculous feat that you helped get accomplished. That is so cool that dogs can help out as they were, at least in that capacity. Can you give us a little bit of a history in terms of military dogs in general? I know that they've been around in the military since, World War I, World War II?
That's correct. Actually, the I read several books when I was in Afghanistan. One of them was a World War II book, and I forget the name of it. Jeez, I wish I knew it off the top of my head, but it was about the messenger dog in the trenches of World War One and and they used them also similar in World War II. But the first, you know, real large use of dogs was actually by the Germans and the German Shepherds back in World War One. But then the British had a large contingent of them, and the Americans were a little slow to the game with dogs. But you know, they really came to light in the 1970s and late 60s during Vietnam, when there were a lot of sentry dogs used, a lot of sentry dogs and a lot of dogs for patrolling. The dogs, you know, and they're still used to that capacity today for a little bit different. What they're looking for is IEDs right now and explosives. But back in Vietnam, they used to be able to hunt down Viet Cong.
Wow.
The Vietnamese soldiers. So, you know, dogs are, they have a lot of multiple uses. And they've been used, you know, consistently since, like I said, World War One, World War Two.
And of course, different dog breeds are used for different tasks. Is that right?
That's correct. A lot of our a large portion of our permanent dog program in the military is founded in the policing of our military. Like, I'm a military police officer,
right,
in the United States Army. So we have permanently assigned dog teams that are assigned to the units that I would be in charge of. And so those dogs are common, you know, like if you see any police force, they are very similar. They're the Belgian Malinois, they're the German Shepherds. And so those are the dogs that we have a lot of in our the Marine Corps has a police force, the Navy has a police force, and they all use this same type of dog. We use sporting breed a lot too, and they're for single purpose dogs. You know, like the police dogs, they're multi purpose.
Right.
Multi purpose meaning they can attack and they can sniff out stuff.
Right.
We also use sporting breed dogs for enhanced off the leash capability, where you're not worried about them attacking someone. You're just worried about them focused on finding explosives or mainly explosives.
And when you say sporting. When you say sporting breeds, are you talking about Labradors, Golden Retrievers, that sort of thing?
That's correct. Labrador Retrievers, I would say those are the primary breed that we use, but there's also all sorts of sporting breed. I mean, pretty much any sporting breed you can think of, we're using in Afghanistan right now, to include Vishlas, which I have two of, so I have like a soft spot in my heart for them.
Very cool. So, In the military, is there one particular base here in the United States that controls the dog program, or is it kind of widespread in several bases throughout the country?
Well, any military installation that you go to in the United States most likely has a dog program. But the program of record is actually assigned to the Air Force. They run the Department of Defense dog school at Lackland Air Base in Texas. So
okay.
It doesn't matter if you're an Air Force person or a Marine, you go to Lackland Air Force Base to be trained, and then you go to your unit where you would pick up your dog there. There's a little bit of different programs, there's different types of programs, but that's generally speaking how it works.
So when a person enters into the military, and I'm a military, I grew up in the military, my dad was in the Marines, so I got a little bit of an understanding on how things work, but when a person joins the military and they're given orders to become a military policeman or a dog handler, can you give us just a kind of a synopsis on how that goes through from when they start to when they're deployed with their dog or with that particular unit?
Sure. You know, the Navy and the Marine Corps have been sending kids right out of basic training and their advanced and visual training to dog school. The Army, what they used to do is, you know, you would have to go to an initial unit for a few years, sort of work your way through, become respected, do your time in a line unit, and then you would get to go to dog school. But the Army is actually changing their philosophy. Because if they send kids younger to dog school, they'll get more use out of those kids throughout their enlistment. So
right.
If you're talking like a young kid, you know, a 18-year-old kid, he comes out of high school and he wants to be a dog handler, first thing he's got to do is qualify to become an MP. And so when he does that, he goes to basic training, then he goes to advanced individual training, which can take, you know, I want to say for the Army, it's about 22 weeks. And then he would go to the 8-week dog course at Lackland Air Base. Once he gets done with that, he would go and be assigned to a unit where he would pick up a dog, because all our dogs are assigned to installations. So, like, what is it, Fort Wainwright up there in Alaska, you guys have, there's maybe, I want to say, 9-11 dogs probably assigned up there.
Uh-huh.
At Fort Wainwright. Those dogs stay there. When the soldiers rotate out, their dog stays there, and they go to a new place and pick up a new dog. So the kids will pick up their dog, they'll train with him, and it really is just dependent on how quickly they could deploy. You know, they could be there a year, they could be there six years, or they could be there 6 months and be on deployment orders. Right now, with Afghanistan slowing down, with the troop declines, I mean, there's going to be, I don't think the kids will deploy quite as quickly as they were in 2010, 2011. So I think they'll have time to train, be mentored a little bit more, which I think is a really good thing. Especially
of course,
when you're talking about a young 18-year-old soldier.
Yeah, of course. There's nothing wrong with too much training, that's for sure. So when a person picks up their dog, as you mentioned, are they with that dog throughout their stay at that particular base, as you talked about Fort Wainwright? So if, you know, a young kid, Private Smith or whatever his name is, comes in and picks up Max, is he with Max that entire time he's up here at this installation, or does he rotate in and out with different dogs, or is he stuck with the same one, so to speak?
Well, normally the kennels are run by a kennel master, and
right.
The kennel master generally makes that assessment. And most of the younger kids, they generally go to narcotics dogs first.
Okay.
And that would be their first option because, you know, if you miss on narcotics with your dog, the stakes are a lot lower than if you miss with explosives. So they want the more experienced handlers with the explosive dogs. So the younger kids will come in and they'll do a narcotic dog initially. And this isn't always the case by any
right.
means. But this would be a model that you would try to use in a dog kennel for progression of a handler, you know, because we want our handlers to develop. And so, and then, you know, if they do, if they work a narcotic dog for a year and then they get transitioned to an explosive dog, and so they have experience in both those types of dogs. So one day when these kids are running their own kennel, they can actually have experience to speak from when they're trying to mentor young soldiers 5-6 years down the road. So we try to build a more well-rounded dog handler.
Exactly. So let's go to the point now where they are deployed, they're in Afghanistan or whatever area of the world that is in conflict at any particular moment. What happens then? Is it obviously they aren't going out and finding explosives every day, I don't imagine. What goes on over there during wartime? Can you give us a little bit of history about that?
Yeah, sure. The interesting thing about the dog handlers is that they deploy alone. So, you know, the Fort Wainwright detachment may have two kids deployed right now, and I don't know if they do. I'm just, you know, throwing that out there. But they wouldn't deploy as a whole unit because they have to have a capability at Fort Wainwright of explosives and narcotics. So they'll take a couple of handlers from this installation, maybe a couple of handlers from a different installation, and they all go to Afghanistan and they deploy as individuals, which I think is a big difference, first of all, with canine handlers compared to, you know, large units, because you might see, you know, the Striker Brigade from Fort Wainwright might deploy. That's 3,000 soldiers.
Right.
So this kid deploys all by himself, and they either go to Kandahar or they go to Bagram Air Base, which is, you know, the two main hubs for our soldiers in Afghanistan right now. And they go through a validation process. And a lot of times these kids haven't been working their dogs in a week or two, maybe a little bit longer, because they were on leave right before they deployed, or, you know, in transit takes a week to get to Iraq. So they really haven't worked with their dog in, you know, recent period. So they got to get back on their leash. And
right.
Also they have to be indoctrinated into the local explosives. We have a lot of homemade explosives in Afghanistan, like ammonium nitrate, ammonium sulfite, that these dogs, you can't get those types of explosives here in the States. So you have to train and you have to imprint those dogs with that scent in Afghanistan before you can put them out in sector with the troops. And so once they've imprinted, once they're validated on all that stuff, once they've become acclimated to the climate and the weather and the conditions, they'll get pushed out throughout Afghanistan to their units. And they're actually assigned to units, and they go out on missions with patrols. And so, you know, I can't – everybody's different. In every unit, they employ their dog teams a little bit differently. But you're absolutely right. I mean, dog teams can't work 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. These dogs aren't machines. They need a break. And
right.
Actually, it was funny. I was editing my book, my second novel this morning, and I was talking about, you know, making how important it was for the leadership to understand that these dogs aren't machines. They need to act like dogs and be able to play once in a while as well.
Exactly. You know, dogs will be dogs whether they're working or not. So when a dog team is with a unit, is it how big are these units, and is there just one dog team per unit?
There's no great answer for that, because, you know, you could have a surplus of dog teams, or you could have not enough dog teams. I mean, you know, it's really hard to define that, because, you know, the first thing is the units always seem to want more dog teams. Because,
right.
I mean, having a dog in front of you on a walking patrol, it does a lot of different things. But I always thought the most important thing it did was it made the soldiers walking behind that dog confident that they could worry about the enemy around them and not worried about the enemy below them in the ground.
Very cool.
Okay.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to follow up with that. When you mentioned that confidence, of course, dogs do that in a variety of ways, and I'm sure that when it has a job as important as finding explosive, that confidence comes with time and time again of building up that bond and that association with that dog. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It's called, you know, funny, I wrote about this morning too. It's unit rapport. You know, when a handler and a dog, they go out with the same unit, the same element, the same platoon, the same squad. They develop a rapport. They develop a trust with one another. And that's one challenge that the handlers have when they deploy with their dog alone. They are the outsider, and they have to prove themselves. They have to have rapport, have credibility, so that they can ensure that that young 22-year-old second lieutenant who's never worked with a dog team employs them properly. It's very important.
So you mentioned second lieutenant. Is this strictly an officer thing, or can enlisted folks be involved in this as well?
Well, to be a dog handler in the military, you have to be enlisted. Now, like, because I'm an officer, I'm in charge of dog teams. I'm in charge of kennels.
Right.
You know, but to actually be a dog handler, you would have to be an enlisted soldier.
Gotcha. Okay, so here we are out on patrol with the dog and his handler. What happens now? Is it kind of a sweeping patrol? Is it just going, you know, obviously we don't want to get too much into military tactics or anything, but what is kind of the day in the life of a dog and a dog handler?
Sure. Your dog handler, you know, stays out on point in front of the squad, in front of the platoon. And they're out front maybe 50 meters in front of the entire platoon. And then out front of the dog handler is the dog, who's maybe, just depending on the dog, anywhere from 10 to 30 feet in front of the handler. And so, you know, you're out there alone as a United States service member by yourself with your dog. And sometimes you can barely see the element behind you that you're clearing the area for. I just think that's really cool that, you know, you've got these young soldiers out there, and they're out there isolated and alone, and all they're trying to do is make it clean, make it clear for their countrymen to be able to walk.
Right.
That's how it works. They're all alone out there by themselves.
How dangerous of a job is this? When people think of military conflicts, obviously they think of the snipers picking them off from the hidden areas and stuff like that. Can you give us a real world example of just how dangerous it is for these folks out there at the front of the pack, so to speak?
Oh, I mean, I don't know if there's a more dangerous job in the United States military than being a dog handler.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're the pulse of the entire patrol. I mean, their life depends on you. I remember the week that I decided that I was going to write a book on this. It was sometime in October 2010, and we had just lost, like, I don't know, 4 handlers in 1 week.
Wow.
And then I just broke my heart. I walked into my office, and there was a Marine dog down Hellman that got lost in a firefight, and he was still missing. So there was, you know, 4 handlers, 3 dogs, and then 1 dog missing. And I just, you know, I just teared it up. And I just, these kids and their dogs out walking front, walking point with their dogs, I just swore to myself that I needed to tell their story. You know, I became so adamant that the public needs to know what these young men and women are doing for their country in a foreign land. So I'm just so passionate about the dog handlers and dog teams and what they've done for the fight. I mean, just like I said earlier about the Brigade Combat Team from the 101st, it wasn't until we were able to get them dog teams that they were able to actually employ their combat force and take back the Agadan Valley.
Wow.
From the Taliban.
Yeah, that's amazing stuff. Kevin, so thank you so much for sharing with us today. I'm sure our listeners, it brings chills down my back, so I imagine it does them as well. So, again, thanks a lot for not only sharing with us today, but, of course, your service and everything that you're doing with this amazing group of guys and dogs. That is so cool.
Oh, thank you, Robert. I really appreciate it.
So we are talking to Kevin Hanrahan today. He is an author as well as a military soldier, officer, lieutenant colonel, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah, thanks again for your service. But let's talk a little bit about your book, Paws on the Ground. We mentioned it at the beginning of the show, and you talked about it just there a second ago about how you wanted to tell their story. But it's also a novel. Why did you go from an nonfiction type book to a novel? Is it more of a story about a group of dogs, or, you know, set the pace for us a little bit for when folks read your book?
I always tell people, like, my one-liner for my book is it's about U.S. soldiers and dogs that protect them in the alien and treacherous terrain of Afghanistan. And it's really a romance. It's the greatest love story of all. It's the love story between a soldier and his dog.
Awesome.
And, you know, I think the best way to tell what's actually going on the ground is through fiction. I think it's an avenue that I had to pursue as an active duty Army officer because I have ethical limitations that I have to abide by. I can't, you know, write and speak for profit or for anything about programs that I've developed. You know, I would love to write like a tell-all book that would include all sorts of high-ranking generals about how we got them to accept the dog program and how we got them to fund it, but I can't because of the ethical implications. So I decided that the best way to do that was to actually write a novel about it. But I swear to you, there's no closer to getting to actually being on point with a dog in Afghanistan than to read my book.
Awesome. When is it? Is it released already, or is it when is it going to be out?
It is with my literary agent right now, and we're looking to get it to a publisher this spring sometime.
Very cool. We'll definitely keep our listeners updated and send over a link on Amazon or wherever it's located when it is released. So, Kevin, when dogs and their handlers are going out on patrol and they come back, you know, their time over in the war arena is over. What happens then? What happens after they get back to the States or wherever they're going?
The dogs and the handlers deploy back together to their home of record. or their home station, I should say. So that young dog team from Fort Wainwright that deployed to Afghanistan for a year, they go back to Fort Wainwright together, and they go on with life. They're at their installation. You know, it's at the installation, there's lots of different missions they do besides the force protection of the mission of the installation. They do law enforcement. And a little-known common fact, little-known fact about the dog program is that the military supports the Secret Service, and they support the UN a lot with dog team missions here in the States and abroad. So I always thought that was really interesting. You know, we have tons of dog teams that have actually provided security for a numerous amount of presidents.
Very cool. So when a team comes back and we're talking about the soldier from Fort Wainwright, obviously up here in Alaska, how soon can they go back into duty at that point? Or, you know, I think a common misconception is once a person is in the military, they're constantly going over to war. But it's not it's not the case, is it?
No, it's really not. You know, they tried to get during the height of when we had, you know, we had Iraq and we had Afghanistan going on, and more dogs. I mean, we only have about 3,000 dogs in the military, dog teams in the military.
Right.
So when your requirement is over 1,000 dog teams, and you have 1,000 getting ready to deploy, and then 1,000 that just got back from deployment, you're maxed out.
Right.
You know, so it's, but I didn't really. But basically what they were trying to do was keep the kids on the ground for at least a year before they redeployed them. But sometimes that was broken because we had mission to make. But, you know, at least a year was what they were trying to do. But, you know, I think the kids will have better time back now, especially with the reduction in troops.
So if we can get back to the kids for a minute, when a young man or young woman signs up for the military, they sign up for a particular number of years, whether it be 2, 4, 6, or you know, stay in as a career, which is, I assume, 20 plus. Is there a requirement for the dog handlers for a particular amount of time in the military?
2 years.
When you
go to dog school, when you go to any school like that, you owe 2 years to the military if you decide to do it.
And when that person is when their time is up, can they re-enlist and stay in the dog program, or are they forced to go somewhere else?
They can stay in. And actually, I take that back. That's 1 year. I'm sorry.
Okay.
In the Army, it's called an additional skill identifier, or commonly known as an ASI. And once you have that ASI, you have to actually have it pulled from your record if you don't want to stay as a dog handler anymore. But I can tell you that I don't know many dog handlers that were dog handlers and didn't want to remain dog handlers.
Yeah, I would imagine that, you know, you got to be a dog person anyway, I assume, to sign up for that assignment. But man, what a better way to spend your military life than with a canine friend as well.
Oh yeah, I mean, you get to hang out with dogs all day long and train them. If that's something that you love to do, I mean, there's nothing better. So, I mean,
yeah.
I would love to do it, but I can't.
So obviously, it's probably a very well sought out position in the military, isn't it?
It is. What they do is, you know, now that they're sending, like in the Army, I know the plan is to send the very best from the basic training units and AIT. The kids that are the top performers get to go. Now, I know when I was a company commander, I redeployed from Iraq in 2005, and I had just a slew of people that wanted to go to dog school, and we sent only the very best from my company to dog school, because you know, as a reward for being a good soldier, you should be allowed to go do something that you want to do.
Exactly. So let's talk about the dog's life. What is it like? What is the working life of a military dog? When people think about service dogs that we train here at Alaska Dog Works, and of course I'm a musher as well, the typical working life for any of our dogs is 7-8 years. What is it like for a military dog?
It used to be 10 to 12 years, but now it's and this is just my estimate. This isn't an official military estimate. This is just Kevin Hanrahan's estimate, but I would say it's anywhere. It's about 8 years. And you could probably predict that that dog probably has at least 4 deployments. And there's no doubt about it that we, our dogs, are over the next few years are going to be retired a lot sooner than they had been because of those deployments, because of those, you know, patrolling in the mountains of Afghanistan. It takes a toll on their bodies just like it takes a toll on our soldiers' bodies.
It does, I'm sure. And when you said four deployments in that 8 years, those dogs are truly earning their stripes during that time. That's a lot of time on the ground, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, you could easily get back from the deployment as a dog, and then your handler changes his duty station, and you get a new handler in that hadn't deployed recently. And guess what? You're going back 6 months later as a dog.
Wow.
With a new handler to Afghanistan, potentially to back right where you were before. So
Kevin,
it's a tough life.
It is. Kevin, can you mention your blog site? I know you're very active on there, and you write a lot, and you have lots of information on there. What is that website?
My website is www.khanrahan, it's HANRAHAN.com. And what I think I love about that site the most is I'm actually taking real stories from real dog handlers, and I'm telling them on that website. So I'm actually – I think I have 2 teams that are actively deployed right now in Afghanistan, and I'm actually telling their stories to the American public. And that was part of what I had mentioned earlier. I want to share their stories. I want to, you know, share their experiences and really – you know, and dare people to what these kids are doing over there in Afghanistan.
And I got to give you credit. You're doing an awesome job there with your stories as well as your information about dog advocacy. I think that's a very important part of this, don't you think?
Oh, I think so. You know, it's really important for me that, you know, people recognize the fact that these dogs, they're not pieces of equipment. They're living, breathing soldiers, Marines, seamen. I mean, they're actual soldiers, and they deserve every respect that we give our two-legged soldiers.
You know, a lot of people understand that fact when you think about the police units, you know, the local police and their dogs. Their dogs are part of the police force. They are truly police officers in the force. How are they recognized, at least in the military? You know, I think a big misconception is they are pieces of equipment and they're often disposed of, you know, kicked to the side, so to speak. But that's not the case anymore, is it?
Well, it partially is. For a very long time, dogs were considered to be equipment. And unfortunately, they are still considered to be equipment in the military. Recently, there was legislation called the Canine Members of the Armed Service Act, which was just passed by Congress and signed into law. And originally, it had 3 tenets to it. The first tenet was retirement and adoption of the military working dogs. And basically what that said was how it used to be was if you had Fido and Fido was stationed in Germany and he was getting ready to retire and Private Smith wanted to adopt military working dog Fido, which is no problem, he would have to pay to fly Fido back to the States, which could be, you know, well over $1,000. And a lot more for a soldier stationed in Korea or a soldier stationed in Italy, a sailor stationed in Italy. So what that law does now is it allows the military to use military transport to fly that dog back to the States at no cost to the soldier, which is a big win. The second tenet was the veterinarian care. You know, when I retire, I'll be eligible to retire in 3 years, and I'll have health benefits the rest of my life. But these dogs, they don't have any health benefits when they retire. The person that adopts the dog has to pay for all veterinarian care. And what this act did was it provides I'm just looking at this real quick. It provides – what the heck was that? I'm sorry. It directs the Secretary of Defense to establish and maintain a system to provide for veterinarian care for military working dogs, and it won't be from tax money. It'll be all from donations. Sorry, I'm walking into the back room. I have a 10-month-old, and he's starting to holler.
That's okay. No problem.
And then the third tenet, which we lost, was recognition of the service dogs. And what we were fighting for was to have them recognized as actual members of the armed service. And that part was not passed. So, you know, hopefully this year, Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut and Congressman Walter Jones from North Carolina are going to continue to fight for our military working dogs and give them the recognition that they deserve.
And with that recognition, what do you guys expect to happen if that does pass?
Well, the first thing I would like to see is, you know, right now we give these a recognition of their service is the biggest thing. Service recognition. You know, when you deploy as a soldier and you do a good job, you generally get a medal, an award, or something for being in Afghanistan. It's a recognition of your service. You know, and for me, I have a drawer full of medals, and they don't really mean anything to me. I'm like, okay, whatever. I'm fine with it. But I know someday when I'm out of the military, I'll look back on it and be like, hey, you know what? I was in the military, and I did something with myself. And I just think it's important that, you know, the handlers and the people that adopt these dogs, I think society and I think our military has to recognize the service of our working dogs because they're saving thousands and thousands of lives.
Right. Why do you think that that's such a struggle then? Why don't people just say, wow, they do need this recognition? Why is that such a burden, at least, for right now?
You know, I think it's a societal bias. You know, I think that back when my father was a child, he had a dog, and all it did was sit in the backyard, chained up all day long. You know, and I think society, you know, dogs are becoming family members more so than just pets.
Right.
And I think in the military, our dogs are becoming more than just equipment. They're becoming fellow service members, just like you mentioned earlier about, you know, a fellow cop. A police dog is a fellow police officer. A military dog is a fellow soldier. And they deserve the recognition that our soldiers get.
I totally agree with that. And one of the things that you mentioned on your website is what happens to these dogs when that time comes for them to be out of the service and up for adoption. And you said one of the first things that happens is they're offered to local police departments. Is that the case?
That is correct for training purposes. You know, a lot of times the military will retain a dog that maybe has they think he has a couple good years in him, but just can't perform up to the level that we need our dogs to be able to perform to. But they could be used well as training dogs. A lot of times, you know, when they go to the local police force, though, they're dogs that were washed out, dogs that didn't make it through the program, and maybe they just need to change of scenery.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, traditional military working dogs like Fido up in Fort Wainwright, more than likely what's going to happen is one of his handlers or a soldier that has handled him before is going to adopt him out. In the military, what we try to do is mirror and provide them to former dog handlers because, I mean, we can't forget that, you know, a patrol trained dog is a trained attack dog, and you need to have someone that knows how to handle a trained attack dog.
You know, that was my next point exactly. You know, so a lot of people think, wow, I would love to have one of these guys in my home, but they're not your typical Labrador that lays at your feet when you're watching Monday Night Football. These guys are very high drive, high intensity dogs, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And now, you know, we have different types of dogs. We do have Labradors, which, you know, would be more suited for, you know, a family, would be well suited for a family with children and such. But, you know, for me, I wouldn't feel comfortable having, say, a patrol explosive detector dog that, you know, is a Belgian Malinois around my family right now. I just wouldn't. I have a 10-month-old son, And it would make me really, really nervous because, you know, that they're trained attack dogs.
Right, exactly. So when these dogs are adopted out to the military families, are some of these guys still in the dog program, obviously working with other dogs, but they have, you know, retired Fido at the house? Is that a pretty common scenario?
Definitely. Absolutely.
It is.
That is very, very common. And just, you know, when a retired dog retires, we don't allow any civilian dogs at military kennels. You know, so you could never, that dog, Fido, is just not allowed to go back to the military kennels anymore.
He's retired. So, he can live the good life at home then.
They are spoiled, rotten dogs when they retire because, you know, we're retiring these dogs out to dog lovers.
Exactly.
And most likely, you know, like my wife is a dog lover too. So, I mean, you know, like type people. You know, so they have a whole family of dog lovers and people that will pet them and take care of them and spoil them rotten all day long. So,
Kevin, you mentioned that there's about 3,000 dogs at any given point in the military working at any given time. What's going to happen now that, as you mentioned, things are kind of winding down in Afghanistan and God forbid something else happens in the near future where everything ramps up again, some other portion of the world? What's going to happen to the dog program in the near future, hopefully without any major conflicts?
Well, the answer to that, I have to explain to you what has happened to the dog program over the last 5 years. You know, the 3,000 that I mentioned, and that's just an estimate, that's a program of record. Those are permanently assigned dog teams to the United States military. What we've been doing over the last 5 to 10 years is we've been expanding the dog program to meet the emerging needs of commanders in Afghanistan and Iraq. So the Marine Corps has developed the improvised explosive detector dog. So, you know, I'm sure you've seen it on my site or some other sites where you see the pictures of the black Labrador retrievers. That's their non-program of record dog program that's going to go away when this war dies down. We have in the Army the program that I developed, the tactical explosive detector dog program, which is very similar to the Marine program. It's a non-program of record, and it was meant to meet the emerging needs of the commanders in the field. And so those programs will go away, and the programs that remain will be the ones that were the program of record. And so, you know, it will be really transparent to most people.
And like you said, that they don't just do the explosive detection. They're doing patrol and sentry and all sorts of other jobs. Obviously, those jobs are still going to be required, even just for daily patrol on the installation. Is that right?
We don't really have sentry dogs right now. You know, in the grand scheme of what, you know, sentry dog being strictly patrol, strictly guard. Sentry dog, you think of as a guard dog. We don't
right.
really have those, but our military dogs do perform patrols. They're patrolling type dogs, so they can do that. But we will retain that capability on almost every single military installation.
And are those dogs that are on the military installations, are they similar to the local police department's dogs, where they're enforcing law on the base, or are they doing some other type of job?
Nope, that is correct. I think I might have mentioned it earlier. I can't remember if I did, but the program of record, the permanent military dog program, belongs to the police and corps of our military.
Right.
So as a military police officer, you know, the organization that I'm affiliated with here has 9 dog teams that are permanently assigned to my installation. Now, one or two of them may be deployed at any given time, but the rest of them are in some state of law enforcement support and base installation support.
Right, right. And they're doing, like I said, what I assume is typical daily duties like you might see your local canine cop doing, patrolling and, you know, working in that capacity, I'm sure.
That's right. Working the gates, working health and welfare inspections for unit commanders in regards to the drugs, just doing general patrolling with their handler. There's a multitude of missions that you may see a dog team doing on a military installation at a given time.
We're talking to Kevin Hanrahan today. He is an author, a lieutenant colonel in the Army, as well as a person that works very heavily with the dog program in the military. Kevin, anything you want to add? We have about 10 minutes left. You know, I know our focus wanted to be on just giving an education, so to speak, on military dogs and talk a little bit about your book, but is there anything else you would like to share with our listeners today?
Well, I just urge everybody to, you know, one thing that I would like to mention is post-traumatic stress syndrome. There's a lot of challenges that we're having in the military right now with post-traumatic stress syndrome in our soldiers. And, you know, it really hasn't been scientifically proven yet, but the proof is in the pudding that dogs are helping with that, with their soldiers. And there's lots of organizations out there that are actually assisting veterans and providing them with PTSD service dogs and therapy dogs. And I've got some pieces on my website about that, but that's something that I'm really passionate about is taking care of our veterans, because I think we're going to have a lot of challenges with our veterans over the next 10, 20 years, just like we saw a lot of challenges with Vietnam veterans in the 70s and 80s. I think it's going to be very similar to that.
Right. Yeah, and we do a little bit of work with that as well, providing therapy dogs and things with folks not just in the military but that are suffering from PTSD. So I understand those challenges fully, and it is something that's going to have to be addressed because we are going to have a lot of folks that are coming back, and some of those folks are going to need that help.
Yeah, it's a tough thing. I mean, we ask so much of our service members, and now as a nation, I believe that we have to take care of our service members. So they go and they put their lives at risk, and you know, I think we have a responsibility as a nation to take care of them.
I totally agree there. Kevin, what do you think is the future? What's going to happen next? You know, everything continually evolves, especially in the military. What do you think is going to happen next in terms of dogs in the military? Any insight you can give on the future of the programs and what we could possibly expect dogs to do? Because they can do just about anything.
Yeah, you know, well, I think the one thing that can be said is that the military dog program has really, really proven its merit. Okay. Really, really proven its merit and importance throughout the military. I mean, you look at quotes from, you know, the highest ranking generals we have in the military about how impactful they were on the fight there in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I just think that, you know, the military program, the challenges we're having right now with the program, though, is the challenge we're having with the entire military, and the military is going to be cut. And,
right.
You know, I this is Kevin Hanrahan's, you know, opinion based off no facts, but the military dog program is not going to be untouched from those cutbacks. That's just the nature of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's going to have to cut back. So I think, you know, my personal opinion on this is that we're going to see a little bit of cuts on the military dog program, but it's going to continue to go on, and we're going to shrink it and have the ability to go ahead and make it large again during the next conflict. And that's sort of what we're doing with our military. You know, now that we wind down, we're going to shrink it and we're going to tighten it, but be prepared to expand it if we need to.
And that's kind of, like you said, that's the nature of the beast of the military. Obviously, we have to be a stronger force during conflict than we do during peacetime, I'm sure.
That's exactly right, you know, and, I mean, that's just how it is. So I just, you know, I know there's been a lot of ARs, and there's a lot of knowledge now and within the military about how important these dogs are for the fight. And I think that the next big altercation that this country gets in, I think one of the first enablers is that the commanders on the ground will be looking for dogs again. So there'll be a lot of, you know, experience out there to be able to provide that. So I think that's a great thing.
Awesome. So we'll definitely keep in touch, Kevin, when your book is released. Maybe we'll have you back on to talk about your book after it's published. I would love to sit down and read it myself. It sounds like an awesome story. And, Kevin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, great, Rob. I appreciate it, and I had a great time talking with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Kevin Hanoran, he is an author as well as a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army. He helps out in training and placing of some of these fine military dogs and their handlers. Kevin, thanks a lot. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Okay. Take care, Rob.
Take care. This is Robert Forto on behalf of DogWorks Radio. We'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.